This is Chelsea speaking, and I'm about to interview sensitive crimes defense attorney Jessa Nicholson Getz. She's an unequivocal badass. When I was listening to her background and stories and insight during this interview, I got a thrill. This is the woman that I've been trying to find. She might be the woman I want to be. I'll let her speak for herself, but she brings a necessary real-world context to this plot as she informs about the fascinating world of sensitive crimes. Any specific people Jessa talks about have signed a waiver allowing her to do so, so please note that attorney-client privilege was not compromised during the taping of this interview. Hi, Jessa. Thank you for taking the time to speak with all of us. As stated, I think you are a tremendous asset, and I'm really excited to start exploring these topics. You and I have been having a riveting discussion over the past few weeks about a variety of subjects relevant to this podcast. So can you start by sharing your name and how you came to work on sensitive crimes?
Sure. So I'm Jessa Nicholson Getz, and I practice under Jessa Nicholson. I have been an attorney that focuses on criminal defense. I practice in the state of Wisconsin. My primary practice area is the Madison or Dane County area, but I do practice statewide. And my particular sort of focus area is what we refer to as conflict crimes or sensitive crimes defense. So there are, even within the more narrow field of criminal defense, there are different types of cases that are common. Some firms really specialize in, you know, for example, drunk driving defense. I have a background initially in victims' rights. So I worked at a domestic abuse rape crisis center before I ever went to law school. And that got me interested in sensitive crimes. And as I moved forward in my own career planning, I came very much to fall in love with the defense side of things. I think there's a lot of value in trying to show people that a defendant is more than the worst thing they've been accused of doing, that they're not always necessarily guilty of what they're accused of doing. But then even if I am dealing with people who have some culpability, to show a bigger picture. So based on a number of things, number one, my interest in the sort of broader constitutional issues that go with sensitive crimes. So Sixth Amendment rights, Confrontation Clause stuff, things that deal rape shield, which we can talk about all of those ad nauseum, but deal with different issues that really come up in person-to-person crime. I like defending cases that have affirmative defenses, so things like self-defense are interesting to me. I like having a story to tell. I'm also one of what is still relatively few, comparatively, women who try serious felony cases. And there's a belief, whether it's supported by evidence or not, and there are conflicting theories on this, but there's a belief that if you are a man in particular accused of committing a crime against a woman, that it can be useful, particularly in front of a jury, to have a female attorney. And so I was looking to build a career, and people were interested in having someone with sort of my background and interest in this that comes in the package that I come in. And so that's where I started out.
Got it. I was hoping we could steer the conversation a bit to a specific case of yours that, in addition to being relevant to our story, is just objectively fascinating. The State versus Andrew Steele. What was this case about?
Sure. So this is absolutely a case that was straight from the television. This was my client, Andy, was a sheriff's deputy here in Dane County, Wisconsin. And he had married his middle school and high school sweetheart, Ashley Steele. So they had been together for 30 years. Andy was diagnosed with a neurological and neuromuscular condition, ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. And he received that diagnosis in June. And locally, at least, it got a lot of attention because really prominent members of law enforcement and even our elected district attorney was doing the ice bucket challenge on the local news with him to try and raise money. And about 2.5 months after his diagnosis, he was accused of committing a double homicide. And his wife was found dead in the home. His sister-in-law, so his wife's younger sister, was also found dead in the home she'd been visiting for the weekend. And Andy was found after having attempted suicide. And some of the circumstances of the wife's death in particular, while there was a gunshot wound to the head, there was also a zip cord around her neck. And cause of death was listed as both the strangulation or the asphyxiation from the zip cord and the gunshot. And as we started to, my business partner and I tried that together, as we started to put together the case, one of the things that came out was that this zip cord was used in sort of BDSM play between husband and wife throughout the course of the marriage. And this became part of the defense. We ultimately raised a not guilty by reason of mental defect defense, using some of the brain damage that was done to his frontal lobe as a result of the ALS as a primary defense. But one of the things that was hotly contested was whether or not his claims that he and his wife engaged in BDSM behavior were true. And so what happened was the prosecution filed notice of an expert who deals specifically with BDSM lifestyles. And it's an officer. It was a retired cop who had worked on some kind of high profile cases with sort of a sexual element. And we get this report. And there are all of these claims that, you know, my office is sitting here reading it. And we're going, well, how do we even start with this? Here's a report that says if Andy were really engaged in BDSM lifestyle, there would be certain types of pornography on his computer. What do we do to defend against that? This is one person's opinion about what, and I'm using air quotes here, about what real BDSM looks like. So then we had to consult with our team of experts that we worked with to talk about what type of person we'd be able to call to testify in response to that. Were we looking for a psychologist? Were we looking for somebody who's active in the community and could testify as to practical experience? Did we want someone in law enforcement to match sort of their law enforcement base? Could we challenge the idea that there's one standard or a gold standard put forth in terms of identifying BDSM practice and the BDSM community? So it started to be all of those types of questions in dealing with this one sort of area of this broader case.
Right. What happened then? Like, what did you decide, or how did you approach this?
Sure. So, you know, the first thing, and let me, I'm going to give you a little bit of legal background on the law in my state. We, to have scientific evidence or expert testimony admitted, it has to be of a certain quality that people in the profession would reasonably rely on the information the expert would testify to. So, for example, a really common piece of evidence that would go in to any criminal trial if they had it would be DNA evidence. Lawyers on both sides can challenge an expert ahead of time and say, I don't think this person can meet the scientific standards that are required to even testify. And we see that in a lot of different ways. We see that where it used to be that people could testify to, you know, hair follicle matching, and that's subsequently been discredited. And so those witnesses are now barred. So the first thing we decided to do was say, we don't think this guy is qualified to speak to this. So the first thing we decided to do was challenge whether or not the state's expert would be even qualified to speak to what the standard is in that. So we did a deep dive and consulted with sociologists and psychologists. We read articles online. I registered for and picked up literature, at least. I didn't attend the whole thing, but a two-day-long fetish conference that was happening in the area, where there were all sorts of different people, like rope experts that we've heard about in your podcast. So I got material from that. I mean, we did everything from reaching out to Dan Savage at Savage Love to talking to Harvard-educated psychologists to figure out, is there a standard way that people have BDSM-oriented sex? And the conclusion that we came to after doing all of that research and speaking to a number of different sources is, no, of course there's not. There are varying degrees and varying levels of that. And it was our perspective and what our psychologists were telling us was that, you know, there's no right or wrong way to do this. And there's nothing that you can look for the absence of. And that was a big part of the state's contention, was that, okay, there wasn't a cache of this type of pornography on computer devices, and that the absence of some of those things could conclude that these people didn't have a legitimate interest in this lifestyle. Your podcast talks a lot about the difference between recreational and lifestyle practitioners. And these were people that were definitely, they were definitely of the recreational participation. When the home was searched, there were some things that lended themselves towards a conclusion that there was some non-vanilla sexual activity. Some of those were, in my view, pretty tame. So, you know, sex toys, you know, dildos or vibrators. That to me isn't necessarily indicative of non-vanilla play, but we're moving in that direction. There were ropes of more than one thickness and more than one softness. I think there were three or four ropes seized, if I'm remembering correctly. There were these zip ties that were seized that people testified. I mean, first of all, our client indicated that they would use these both to restrain someone at the wrists and ankles, but also occasionally to engage in breath play. And there were handcuffs and other restraint devices that, again, I wouldn't describe them as professional. I think that these were more of experimental people. Right. But, you know, nonetheless, there were things that indicated that. And it didn't seem accurate that we should be combing the absence of evidence to draw a conclusion about someone's lifestyle. So that was, the preparation really went into challenging this expert. And then what we ultimately decided to do was have our psychologist, whose primary area was dealing with more neurological issues, but we ultimately decided to have our psychologist speak to patterns of behavior and comfort levels and patterns of behavior in intimate relationships, and talk about the different ways that those things can look. So that was how we ultimately approached it, was doing a pretty aggressive challenge of this retired police officer's ability to testify to certain aspects of it. We were able to get some of the conclusions excluded because there just wasn't a lot of basis for them. This is a little tangential, but he had this list of websites. And so the first thing that we did was, okay, let's go look at these websites. What are on these websites? And, you know, the names were exactly what you would expect. It'd be like tiedandgagged.com or things of that nature that made reference to bondage and restraint. And, you know, here in the guy's report, he's talking about how these are kind of the equivalent to this fat finder that we're hearing about in deliberations, which is this huge community. And the absence of evidence of using that indicates that this was not a real interest. And many of those websites actually turned out to be completely defunct or had moved to new locations. So his information was really outdated. And so that was where we started. And then we kind of went from there. That was a long-winded way to answer that question.
No, not at all. I found all of it fascinating. It sounds like you were trying to prove something that might seem common sense, which is, you know, everyone's different, everyone practices differently, everyone's sex life is different. But because of your legal position, you had to do this extensive amount of research to show that.
And on the other side of it, so we get our witness, you know, we get the state's witness list, and some of the witnesses are literally people that went to the gym with the deceased woman, who said she always wore loose gym clothes because she didn't like to be tight or confined. And what they were asking the jury to do was say, well, if somebody doesn't like a sports bra that's too tight, there's no way that they would ever want to be restrained in the bedroom. And I mean, obviously that's a problematic way to think.
It is. I'm sorry to laugh, but that strikes me as ridiculous.
We laughed a lot about it. If there's one thing that's true over here at my office, we do a lot of laughing about the assumptions that people make about sexual preferences.
Yeah. How seriously, was the BDSM theme explored at trial, or do you think that that was like a significant factor when it came to the way the jury saw and understood the defendant?
So I would tell you that too, and I should let everyone know. So he was, Andy was found not guilty by reason of mental defect. And one of the things that the state argued was that the way that his wife's body was positioned in the bedroom with ligature marks around her wrists and I believe ankles, if I'm recalling correctly, and then having this zip tie around her neck, which he had given some statements right after being arrested that he had attempted to cut it and couldn't get it cut. I do think the jury had to accept that that was an explanation for those ligature marks. So I do think they had to endorse the idea that some of this behavior was occurring between this couple to get to the conclusion that they came to. So it was important, particularly because the state ultimately ended up suggesting through their pathologist testimony that some of those ligature marks could be read as ritualistic in a homicide context, which, of course, we totally disagreed with. But the testimony was, oh, this body must have been positioned in a ritualistic way to deal with some type of sexual deviance. And we just said, well, no, this would be a mark that's consistent with someone who has been restrained. And that's all you can say about that. You can't say whether or not this restraint was voluntary, but we have obviously a statement that suggests that it was. And their alternate view was, oh, no, there's no way that anyone would have volunteered to use this toy in this way. So it did matter quite a bit in terms of how the jury would view her last few moments. Was this a couple that was engaged in consensual sexual activity, or was she tied up and restrained with these zip ties in a premeditated way? And if they believed that it was premeditated and violent, then that really would cut against our assertion that our client was unable to conform his conduct to the law. Right. So it was important to have them accept our theory of why these zip cords and these ligature marks were there.
Right. Do you find that in this trial and in your work in general that a lot of what you do is sort of fighting expectations or preformed judgments about sexual lifestyles that are just untrue?
Oh my God, yes. so much. And let me just start by saying that if there are, Madison, Wisconsin's a college town, okay? And I realize that I'm in the Midwest and people are probably like, nobody in the Midwest is this weird in terms of kinky stuff. Let me tell you, it is cold here and we are drunk and there's not a lot to do, like 10 months of the year. So there are all sorts of things that happen in rural counties in the Midwest that nobody would ever expect. And I was surprised to learn that too. This is a college town, so a lot of the sexual assaults I defend are campus sexual assaults. Let me just say this, and then I can talk to you a little bit about different lifestyles and the way that those go on trial. For the love of God, children, college students everywhere should listen to the way that subs and doms negotiate hard and soft limits. And even if you're a vanilla sexual practitioner, just have that negotiation sober ahead of time. It will save everyone from miscommunications.
Yes. It's so funny to bring that up. Like I've read an article about how, you know, a lot of people are suggesting, or at least there's this one train of thought that the negotiations for consent that occur within the BDSM community should be applied to sexual education in general, because it's thorough it's just everything is about affirmative consent in advance. And there's like just very little room for ambiguity, generally speaking.
Correct. And I think that part of those negotiations in this context, particularly, really give us some insight on some long-held conflicts within the legal system and feminism and how we deal with consent. And I'll just say that in a less vague way. What I mean is the BDSM community uses safe words in part because there's this tacit acknowledgement that no doesn't always necessarily have to mean no. And that's a very uncomfortable conversation to have especially, you know, in the face of wanting to be pro-survivor of sexual assault and of domestic violence and wanting to affirm the violations that people assert that they're feeling. But at the same time, sexuality and the way that people navigate their sexuality, especially inexperienced people, especially younger people, just is more complicated than that. And there are a lot of cases, especially if there are, you know, alcohol or drugs involved, where people might be blackout drunk but are walking and talking, and then they wake up and have no idea what happened to them. And so all of their actions might have indicated affirmative consent to someone that was watching them, but they objectively were, you know, too intoxicated to consent, or they feel that they're too intoxicated to consent. There are times where people, I don't like the phrase play hard to get because I think it's antiquated, but there are negotiations in any type of initial sexual encounter on a really basic level. We feel out if we're attracted to other people. We feel out, you know, if we're comfortable taking things to the next step. Do we want somebody to kiss us goodnight? Do we want to invite them upstairs? What does that mean? If we say, you know, oh, I'm not going to have sex with you tonight, you just can come upstairs for a drink. And people are saying that because there's, you know, a societal pressure not to seem like you're promiscuous or whatever. There are all sorts of pressures and societal expectations that really jumble up our understanding of consent.
Agreed. It's a really interesting ground, consent in general, and the way that plays out in our lives. When it comes to intoxication, it's like, okay, if the person who feels sexually violated after an encounter was intoxicated, but so is the person they feel violated yep. by, you know, what does that mean? And that's an uncomfortable conversation to have also. So I'm fascinated by a lot of the things you're bringing up, and I hope to explore them a lot more next season too. But obviously, when it comes to sexual consent, they're relevant to the storyline now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, one of the things that I've been consistently struck with when listening to the jurors here talk about things is they're really struggling with whether or not Troy was capable of giving free consent to engage in an autoerotic asphyxiation. And, you know, one thing that is frustrating to me as a defense attorney to listen to it is there seems to be what I would say is a fundamental, at least from what I understand about BDSM relationships, there's a fundamental misunderstanding happening about the level of free will involved in this relationship, or the lack of free will. And there seems to be some real difficulty accepting that someone could enjoy pain being inflicted on them. And I understand why that may not be intuitive to people if that's not a desire that they have or they experience. But it's been very interesting to me to hear just how difficult it is for, you know, Carl and I think Janet to even understand that Troy would have enjoyed this behavior and that he sought that out and that he was, you know, consenting to participating in this relationship because he was getting something from it.
Agreed. And I also think that the dynamic in the jury room is interesting because something I witnessed is that it almost seemed like the people who did want to speak up on behalf of, you know, masochists or someone who enjoyed the BDSM lifestyle, the people in the jury who wanted to speak on behalf of that were also sort of reticent to identify themselves as having done that, or, you know, these are characters. But I remember one moment in the jury room, and I can't remember if it's already played or if it's coming up, but Mandy says something about, well, you know, I'm not a BDSM practitioner. I don't do this at home, or, you know, it's not my thing. But Janet says, well, I'm starting to wonder, and people laughed and then they moved on, you know, with the conversation. But like, I wonder how much that sort of like vulnerability and that judgment in a jury room setting, which is tense enough already, kind of comes into play when it comes to decision making.
Well, and one thing that when I pick juries is always a conversation in every sensitive crime that I try is, what is your personal experience with sexual deviance and sexual assault? And it's often a really difficult choice if you've got somebody who was a victim, whether or not to keep them on. Because sometimes, from a defense attorney's perspective, if someone was an honest-to-goodness victim of a sensitive crime, and you've got a case where you feel as though the complaining witness may not be as honest or as genuine in their victimization, it can be really useful to have somebody who would speak up in a jury room and say, well, wait a minute, I've experienced this. And I don't believe that they're behaving in a way that's consistent with what this experience would look like. You know, prosecutors try and put evidence in all the time about if people's behavior is consistent with a certain type of trauma. And that's something that's a theme through this season of the podcast as well, where people are trying to evaluate from witness demeanor, are they acting like an innocent person or a guilty person? And how do we tell that? You know, the last episode talked about jurors, you know, the jurors talked about wanting to see if she was fidgeting, if Samantha was fidgeting when she testified, or how long it took her to answer a question. And then there's this sort of response of, well, there's no right trauma reaction, or there's no correct amount of time that she could have paused or didn't pause in answering the question. And so that's a tension. And I think when jurors bring personal experiences in, they're probably a lot of times embarrassed to have to raise them. But I think that a lot of people are only able to navigate evaluating a situation that is different from themselves by trying to make it more legible. And so part of any good defense attorney's job is to make lifestyles that on their face seem very different from my potential jurors more legible to that jury, and get them to commit to, even if you don't approve of this or like this, can we all commit to each other that we're going to look at this in a framework of respect and tolerance? Right. And that can be difficult to do.
Yeah, it can be. Especially, as you said, like depending on your own personal experiences and the frame of reference you have as an individual. As a defense attorney, do you find that this podcast might be more frustrating to listen to than a layman?
Well, so I've had such a varying degree of reactions about this. For example, I was listening to the most recent one, the Samantha Hall episode, last night, and I think I started audibly arguing with my vehicle's stereo, where I'm listening to this defense attorney direct Samantha, and she's talking about, oh, when I'm active on FetFinder, it's when I'm at my most creative. And I'm like, yeah, man, get it. You are so normalizing this. This is awesome. Have her talk about what great times they had on the holidays. Let these people see that this is a loving couple who just happens to function differently. And she's talking about this romantic holiday, and I'm like, oh, this is so good. And then she says, you know, and then I made him throw up his dinner. And I'm just like, man, you had to have spent how many hours talking to this woman, your client, about all of the different things in their lifestyle, and you chose to bring out on direct one of the least relatable examples of power and control that I can think of. Like, why would you do that? you know, give him something that's a little sexier. Like, have them talk about, oh, I'd pick out his clothes, or, you know, something that people who are a little more vanilla can be like, oh, I see how that would, you know, oh, he ordered my food, or I ordered his food. That's like more relatable. And so that was frustrating to me. Actually, I have a lot of frustrations with the defense. Like, why there isn't a submissive that has testified in this trial for the defense is driving me crazy. Why there hasn't been an explanation of how Samantha and Troy specifically use safe words or signaling to check in on each other. That has not been explored in the way that I would explore it if I were putting this in. You know, so I mean, there are a lot of things that on the defense side, I'm like, you have to explain this better. You know, you're kind of letting the prosecution run away with the oddities, so to speak, of this lifestyle. So it is frustrating on that end. It's also simultaneously frustrating and entirely unsurprising to hear jurors go right to things that, at least in Wisconsin, they're specifically instructed not to do. you know, we have instructions relating to character evidence. And there are a whole body of cautionary instructions that if evidence is introduced about certain character traits for some reason, and I can give you an example. I tried a case, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, where my client was a swinger. And part of, he was accused of sexually assaulting a family member. And part of the defense was that this girl, and she was a child, she was a young teenager, that this girl came to know a lot about her mother and stepfather. He was the stepfather, about their sexuality because they engaged in this swinger lifestyle that this child was exposed to and arguably even exposed to in a harmful way at a young age, and that that would provide the basis for this child's knowledge about sexual activity. And so in that case, I knew that I wanted to be able to talk about all of the things that the child would have seen, because a common question is, why would someone make this up? And even though that's a burden shifting question, it's still one that it's the reality of a defense attorney's job that we have to be prepared to be able to offer alternative theories for why someone would say something other than it being absolute truth. And in that case, I wanted to be able to say, you know, there are a lot of different ways that this kid could have learned about this. So I asked for and received an instruction that said, okay, you've heard some evidence that these people have this polyamorous lifestyle. You shouldn't use that to determine whether or not the defendant is a good or a bad person. You shouldn't use it to determine whether or not he's guilty of any particular crime. It's been offered to you for a very narrow purpose, and that purpose is to explain potential sources of knowledge. So, you know, that's an instruction that we have to give a lot of the time if we're introducing something that can be sort of cast as character evidence. And here, starting in the first episode, there was this whole conversation of, well, who is this defendant? Who is this defendant? What is her character? Is she dominant in role only, or is she a sadist who's antisocial and wants to commit murder? And what's hard is a lot of the evidence to complete a picture of a defendant, a judge would rule as inadmissible anyway. I don't get to tell you whether my defendant was sexually assaulted for 10 years of her childhood, and that's why she likes being a submissive, or if early in her childhood she realized that she enjoyed role play and had a completely healthy and pro-social sexual development that just happens to involve kinks. A lot of the time we don't get to provide that information to juries. And so they are left to speculate about that. And I think it's a really human reaction, because I think we like to be told stories and we like to have the pieces to put together. And so I simultaneously understand why a jury would be so interested in doing that, but also see the pitfalls of how that can really harm defendants who have less mainstream desires.
Yeah, I think it is a human reaction. But again, it can be troublesome.
Oh, yeah.
In a jury room. So we're running a little short on time, but there's one question I really wanted to ask you before I have to let you go. And that is, I imagine that, you know, as a defense attorney, I get, it's unrealistic for you to expect or to expect you to believe that every single one of your clients is innocent of every charge waged against them. So
sure.
I imagine that a lot of people ask you, how do you defend guilty people?
Oh, yes. That's probably a question I get asked at every cocktail party I ever attend.
I'm going to ask it of you again. how do you defend guilty people?
Okay, so to start out, I'm absolutely a patriot, and that sounds cheesy and chintzy and lame, but I really love my country, and I really think that we have a justice system that wants to do good and wants to protect the innocent and wants to give vindication to those who have been wronged. And while it is full of flaws and broken in so many different ways, I don't think that we can throw the baby out with the bathwater and try something new. I think what we've got is a good start. And it gets better and more accurate if there are zealous, competent people on each side making those adversarial arguments. So I think it's just fundamental to the function of our society that someone do this. Number two, I have some political beliefs such that I am an outspoken critic of the prison industrial complex. I do not believe that some of the historical motivations for punishment, so, you know, sort of retribution and the idea of general deterrence, I don't believe that those actually serve to reduce crime. And if the goal is that we want people to be as crime-free as possible, then I think we should be doing things to actually achieve that goal. And it is easy when you get to know a person and their family and understand that maybe they made a decision, usually under the influence of some type of substance, often with some type of limiting mental health issue, though not always, but that they made a decision that even may have been criminal, but is going to set them up to never be able to reintegrate into society. That troubles me greatly. And I don't think, except in cases where someone is such a detriment to public safety that we just simply have to warehouse them and get them away from others because they'll just harm anyone in their touch, I don't think that what we do in sentencing is very effective. And then the last thing I'll say about that, well, and just to briefly expand on that, you know, I by the time I have a trial with someone, I've spent 300 hours with their police reports, with them, with their family. So they're this whole person to me. They're not just a few moments in time that center around the offense. They are brothers and sisters and children and philosophy majors and dentists. And, you know, I mean, they're the people that we see at the grocery store every day. And they're not any different than you or I. They are just somebody who's accused of or maybe even did do something that's criminal. And, you know, the final thing that I would say is if you think that it's difficult to defend a guilty person, try defending an innocent person. There is nothing that will make you sicker to your stomach than laying in bed at night at 1 o'clock in the morning when you're about to start a trial or you're in the middle of trial and realizing that, you know, the prosecution's got three lawyers on the case and two investigators and the entire police force, and they have more or less seemingly unlimited resources for experts, and your defendant has you and whatever team you put together. That's an incredible amount of pressure. And the cases that are the hardest to do are the ones where actual innocence is a possibility. Because, you know, if somebody is guilty, they absolutely deserve a defense. I give them the best defense they possibly can get. I do everything I can to hold up my constitutional bargain. And arguably, if they're guilty, then justice is done when they're convicted. If somebody is innocent, then if I mess up, that person's spending the rest of their life in the cell. And I don't really want to go to sleep knowing that every night.
Oh my God. It blows my mind. Like, I'm crumpling under the pressure of making a podcast and you are like the idea of defending an innocent person in a court of law would just totally overwhelm me. I'm so impressed and in awe of you for having the strength to do that. And I'm really grateful as well that there are just people as impassioned and insightful as you that want to be defense attorneys, because you're so badly needed in this country. So thank you. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. And I know that not everyone shares that opinion about defense counsel, but whenever someone needs me, they're always pretty happy that I'm on their team.
Absolutely.
They might not like me until they need me, but...
This interview was fascinating. If people want to find out more information about you and or your work, how can they do that?
Sure. So my law firm has a website. We maintain a blog, a couple blogs actually, on that. That's www.nglawyers.com. That's NG like not guilty. You can follow me on Twitter at 456 AM. That's my personal Twitter account. The firm's Twitter account is NG Lawyers, and that's at Nicholson Law.
Perfect. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, Jessa.
Thanks for having me. I hope that we can chat again.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to track you down until that happens. She's amazing, right? You will be thrilled to hear I'm speaking to Jessa again next week about issues facing the jury system. If there are any specific questions you'd like me to ask Jessa, please email them to deliberationspod@gmail.com. In 2 days, we're dropping episode 11. A.D. Lowerty and Mr. Cortez lay out closing arguments. Jurors go over instructions and contemplate the emotional taxation of their long-lasting deliberations, what's waiting for them at home, and fears over public reaction to their verdict. We'll see you in 2 days.